Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 35-page appendix of an intelligence report leaked to BuzzFeed, a two-page summary of which was presented to President Obama and President-elect Trump last week, which contains damaging and salacious information on Donald Trump as a target of a Russian compromise, a kompromat operation aimed at influencing our recent election. Phil Giraldi, a former CIA officer, now executive director of the Council for the National Interest, who has an article at the American Conservative, How a Former CIA Officer Reads the Trump Dossier, joins us to discuss Donald Trump's reaction to the explosive charges in the dossier, which describes potential blackmail that the Russian intelligence services could hold over Trump, and alleges that Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, held secret meetings with Russian officials in Prague during the campaign. Then, as Donald Trump continues to defend Vladimir Putin while calling criticism of his alleged ties to Russia fake news and the intelligence services which produced the leaked dossier Nazis, we will look into the frightening rise of authoritarian populism in the West. A veteran senior congressional staffer, Mike Lofgren, the author of The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government, joins us to discuss his article at billmoyers.com. Maybe this is how democracy ends, and whether Donald Trump, as he assumes the presidency, will be able to replace the Secret Service with private bodyguards, as he plans to do, and purge the intelligence community of critics while corralling the press, which he denigrates and despises. Then finally, we will examine the promises made today at Trump's press conference by his tax lawyer, who showed up to make an announcement that Trump would maintain ownership but turn over his businesses to his sons, and that he would not engage in foreign deals. Danielle Bryan, the executive director of POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, joins us to discuss the absurdity of this proposed firewall between Trump and his sons, and Trump's closing remarks at today's press conference that if his sons fail to do a good job after his time in office, Trump would turn to them and say, "You're fired." And joining us now is Phil Giraldi, who spent 17 years as a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism throughout Europe and the Middle East. He now works for the private sector doing security consulting and writes a column in the American Conservative on international security issues. And his latest article at the American Conservative is How a Former CIA Officer Reads the Trump Dossier. Welcome to Background Briefing, Phil Giraldi.
Thank you, Ian.
And So I was hoping to start out with you today, Phil, because this is obviously a lead story. Let's go to the context here. This 35-page appendix of this intelligence report that was leaked to BuzzFeed, I believe, a two-page summary of this was presented to President Obama and President-elect Trump last week. First of all, who do you think leaked it? Would the author of this leaked it, do you think? This is not the two pages from which this appendix was taken. So what is the story about this Christopher Steele fellow, this former MI6 officer who now has a consulting, intelligence consulting business called Orbis Business Intelligence?
Well, I mean, basically, the story is that that his company in London was contacted by Republicans who were hostile to the prospect of Donald Trump proceeding in the electoral process, and he was basically commissioned with digging up dirt on the Trump relationship with Russia, generally speaking. So that's the origin of the story. We're talking about last spring or summer when this whole thing started. After the Republicans, I guess, got a little bit cool on it, the Democrats who were anti-Trump apparently picked up the contract. So here we have a guy in London who is a former MI6 officer who essentially has been paid to find negative information on Donald Trump, and he was paid by both Democrats and Republicans. And since he's a businessman, he obviously would be motivated to produce just that. a story that is as negative as possible about Donald Trump. And there are a bunch of anecdotes and other types of information in this report that some of us would find incredible. And this is, to me, in my own insight, having worked for these kinds of companies in the past, I would suspect that this is more driven by business considerations than anything else.
So why then did the intelligence services, that's the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, and the Director of National Intelligence, can apparently include this as an appendix in this secret report, which they made a public, they made public a very, very small portion of it. Then they apparently took two pages, or summarized this 35 pages, at least that's what we understand, into two pages, and those two pages were presented to both President Obama and President-elect Trump. And given the content of these 35 pages, whether they reduced down to two pages or not, I imagine if you were Donald Trump, you'd be pretty alarmed, wouldn't you?
Well, you would be, except, again, there's context here. The intelligence services, or the FBI in particular, seemingly have had most of this information since the summer. And they haven't apparently been able to corroborate many of the details that are in the report, which makes the whole exercise rather suspicious. But if you take their arguments at face value, what they basically were saying was that we felt that since this information and these allegations were out there, it was the right thing to do to make sure that both President Obama and Donald Trump knew, at least in gist, what was out there. And I think that's a reasonable argument in this case. Now, you might question the timing on this coming shortly before the inauguration. And it's obviously a very volatile issue in terms of, again, questioning Trump's credibility and also questioning whether the legitimacy of his election. So there are political issues that intrude on this, and I'm afraid, of course, we don't have good answers for that kind of stuff at the present time, and we may never have good answers. But it's a very complicated equation that we're seeing here in terms of people weighing off different interests, and the different interests come out with this product, which of course now everyone is questioning.
And again, I'm speaking with Philip Giraldi, a former CIA officer. He's executive director of the Council for the National Interest, and he has an article at the American Conservative, How a Former CIA Officer Reads the Trump Dossier. Well, the FBI, of course, is primarily a law enforcement operation, and then, you know, they've never been that great at intelligence, I don't think. There's a different mission. They're there to solve crimes. The CIA's job is to encourage people to commit crimes against their own government, right?
So,
it's a different culture. So I don't know that the FBI are the right people to look into this. If the sources on this are Russian, and the report indicates that there was a split in the FSB, that the older pros, like Putin's former chief of staff, Sergei Ivanov, who was fired, and his prime minister Medvedev, supposedly warned against this hacking and interfering with the U.S. election. They thought it was reckless. Peskov, the propagandist who's close to Putin, apparently was running it. This is what the report says, and this has been out there in other sources as well. So I don't know where the leaks are coming from on the Russian side, but has anybody ever seen this videotape that's talked about, this extraordinary antics of these young Russian women, and allegedly with Donald Trump at the Red Fruit Hotel in Moscow?
As far as I don't know, and I would observe just from a judgment on Donald Trump based on what we've heard over the last year, I would find that his cavorting with prostitutes would hardly be something that would disturb him.
Right.
So I don't think that would be the right button to push. You know, this report, if you read the whole 35 pages, it has a lot of contradictions in it, but there are a lot of things that were familiar to me. as I noted in my article on the American Conservative, having worked in the private sector with companies that do international investigations, the language was kind of right. It was like you have a client out there that's desperate to get information, negative information, for its own purposes, and so you're feeding them reports every 6 weeks or 8 weeks or something like this, and that's the way these reports read. I mean, we have this and we have this and we have this, and that way you're keeping the money flowing, you're keeping the business interests flowing, and so I found the content, that kind of context, very credible. I found the reports themselves, there was a lot of stuff that was quite ridiculous, and there was even stuff in there that made no sense whatsoever. But that's a separate issue, I think. I think that we will discover that this is a story that will essentially disappear because it's the internal contradictions in what it's saying and how it's saying it basically will make it go away.
But this leads you to question why the intelligence services even included it. And the fact that Donald Trump has already, as the DNI recently said in Senate testimony, has already been disparaging of the intelligence services. Now he's even more disparaging. He's calling this stuff fake news, and he's referring to the people inside the intelligence community as behaving like Nazi Germany. I mean, this is no way to get off on the right foot. It feels like. Do you think he's going to try and purge the intelligence business? I mean, you know, we were talking earlier with Mike Lufkin that he wants to, you know, doesn't even trust the Secret Service and wants to have his own bodyguard. So do you think, I mean, in other words, you know, I don't know whether this Christopher Steele guy leaked this, but we don't know who leaked it, do we? I mean, Trump's almost assumed that his own intelligence service is his enemy, and they leaked it.
Well, it was apparently the original copy was passed to the FBI legate in Rome. It was passed by Orbis as apparently some kind of courtesy. That's my understanding right now. But anyway, I think you have to understand that there are two CIAs, two FBIs, two NSAs, two Secret Services. Trump is convinced with a lot of justice, I think, that the people at the top of these organizations have been politicized and are essentially part of and parcel of the Obama administration. Most of them probably were supporters of Hillary Clinton. Now, when Trump replaces these people at the top, the people who are below, who are the working stiffs, these people basically don't have the same perspective. They're not politicized. They do their jobs. And I would, from my context at CIA, I would bet that 80% of the rank and file of CIA voted for Donald Trump. So I don't think there's going to be an institutional problem going down the road with any of this after the management at the top has been lopped off. I think that's basically what is going to happen. I think that's what we're going to see. Trump will rely on these organizations just the way every president has had to rely on these organizations. And I think that's the way it's going to turn out.
But do you think, for example, by what you've just told us, Phil Giraldi, that the FBI director is very pro-Trump and pro-Republican, isn't he? I mean, it's not... He was even asked the other day by some of the senators that how come you don't want to release any information about this report that McCain gave you months and months ago, yet you were all too eager to release the report a week before the elections on Hillary Clinton. It turned out to have nothing to it.
Yeah, well, I think the essential problem for a person like Comey, who is a very much a straight shooter, is that they get into these political waters and into situations that are fraught with political considerations, and they don't know how to deal with it. And I think there are a lot of different ways to go on some of these things that we've seen happen over the last few months. But these people don't always make the right decisions, and it's not a question of you know, they have the experience as cops or as intelligence officers that doesn't prepare them very well for understanding the political nuances of what happens. I think Comey will almost certainly resign immediately after the inauguration, admitting basically that he's mishandled a lot of this stuff. And as I say, the rest, the others that are under the control really of the president, are all going to be replaced anyway. So I think that, you know, you have there's a tendency to oversee things and overthink that what's going on is, I see today, references to this as like a quiet coup or something that the intelligence services and law enforcement services have been conducting against Trump. I don't see it that way. I see this as just pure politics in terms of how the people see their own interests.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's talk about the bigger issue here, and which is that these two nuclear-armed superpowers have a broken relationship that's on the downward trajectory. And, you know, there are some reports that Tillerson and Trump and Putin want to revive Russian oil, which is an energy-based economy, maybe even do a deal similar to Nixon's China initiative in 72, where the U.S. and Russia ally against China. That seems a little far-fetched and perhaps naive. Even work together against terrorism, which apparently was what Mike Flynn wants to do. There, you know, obviously the Ukraine sanctions would have to be lifted for any of those deals to happen. But in general, the thing that worries me is that we could be getting into a situation where the hawks on both sides are going to win, and that is the military-industrial complex in Russia definitely is opposed to Kudrin's faction and the liberals who want to get more involved in the West. And if the U.S. and Russia got deeper involved in business ties, as the Americans have done in China, after all, that would be at the expense of the big state industries and the military-industrial complex in Russia. And it just concerns me a little bit that some of our hawks, like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, are the spear carriers for this anti-Putin movement, even though there's plenty of reason to be opposed to Putin. I just wonder whether this is a case of the hawks on both sides trying to scuttle a possible détente or rapprochement.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, the interest of both the Russian people and American people is détente. And I think Trump recognizes this, and Hillary Clinton certainly did not. And you're absolutely right. I think that there are a lot of people who have a vested interest, vested material interest, in keeping something like a Cold War going, where you have enemies on both sides, and the enemies support this infrastructure. You want to call it the military-industrial complex. I mean, the Russians have their own version of it, and we have it too. And people like John McCain and Lindsey Graham have been feeding off of this sentiment for years. And so it's in our interest to try to come to some kind of understanding with Russia in terms of Russia's position in the world and versus America's position in the world. We have to find some middle ground, because the hostility that's been in the media has been incredible. It's hysteria in terms of how the media has been looking at Russia for months now. And this is ridiculous. Russia is not a threat to the United States except in one context, which is that if we push them into a corner far enough, we could have a nuclear war. And people have to start understanding that fundamental reality that, you know, basically we have to work together and we have to basically find where we have that middle ground. And I think that certainly that is something that our political class and our media should be pushing for. But, of course, they're not. They're pushing the other way.
Well, but on the other hand, even today, Trump admitted that the Russians hacked our elections. I mean, you know, that's not exactly a friendly act.
Well, no, they didn't hack our election. They hacked into, if they did it, and I still haven't seen any evidence, if they did it, they or a surrogate hacked into a computer that was being used by the Democratic National Committee to cover up various, shall we say, improprieties that they were committing. It's not exactly like they hacked the election. It's not exactly that RT International is seen by tens of millions of Americans, and the fact that they reported things that were negative about Hillary Clinton changed the result of the election. So this is nonsense to say that the Russians changed the result in the election. There were a lot of things that affected the election, and I would put the Russians very low on that list.
Well, Phil Giraldi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Anytime, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Phil Giraldi, who spent 17 years as a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism throughout Europe and the Middle East. He's now executive director of the Council for the National Interest, and he has an article at the American Conservative, How a Former CIA Officer Reads the Trump Dossier. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the frightening rise of authoritarian populism in the West.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who is a longtime staffer in the spent 28 years in Congress, the last 16 of which were senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committee. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and The Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. He has an article at BillMoyers.com, Maybe This Is How Democracy Ends. The frightening rise of authoritarian populism in the West is a very real, clear, and present danger. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here.
And Mike, this press conference that took place today was pretty extraordinary. I mean, the idea that this Donald Trump is not even president yet, and yet the questions that are being asked to him, the subtext of these questions being asked to him from this leaked dossier involve him urinating on Russian prostitutes. I can't think of an elegant way to say that. But, I mean, my God, how low has the bar become here when you've got, you know, this this all takes place the day after President Obama's farewell address, where his ratings remain high, and he had an absolutely scandal-free 8 years. And now we haven't even started, and all the pundits, almost all of them, I don't know about the Fox people, but are more or less saying that his pledges by his tax lawyer today in this peculiar press conference amount to nothing, that, you know, there's no way he can recuse himself. You can't put a firewall up between you and your kids who are running your business. I mean, you sit down at dinner and you're not allowed to talk about what's going on. The whole thing's absurd. So you've got the possibility of massive corruption, conflict of interest, lawsuits out of the gate, and you've got the shadow of Russian intelligence operatives hanging over a presidency that hasn't already begun.
Well, yes, that's right. I think the mainstream media gave a heavy workout to words like titillating and salacious today to avoid actually describing what was going on or what was alleged to have gone on. And I find the whole thing rather ironic that given that the core constituency of the GOP basically wants to enforce Leviticus and execute people for picking up sticks on the Sabbath, yet their newfound hero is Trump, who is sort of the poster child for vulgarity. But again, he's now essentially the person who potentially is the major beneficiary of the DNC hacks, has now conceded it was the Russians, even as he praised them indirectly and by implication, when he said what an important info it was that he dug up, that the Russians dug up, namely that Hillary had gotten debate questions in advance, that does not seem to be such a big deal when, for instance, in 1980, George Will gave questions in advance to Ronald Reagan.
Well, he did actually praise Vladimir Putin for rejecting these claims, and he made it clear that he appreciated the fact that the Russians were rejecting claims that, that their intelligence services were involved in chicanery, which on the surface, of course, is an absurdity. I mean, they all do this, you know. So where is the, I guess we're waiting for the tape, right? I mean, this...
I mean, I can only quote Christine Keeler in the Profumo scandal trial when she said, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? And of course Putin's going to say that. But I work, you know, for a long career in national security, and this is the kind of thing large states with big intelligence services do, particularly Russia. It goes back to the Okhrana in Tsarist Russia. Now, Oleg Kalugin is a former KGB who made the rank of general, but he got on the wrong side of Putin. He says that the hacking that's been going on is basically an extension of traditional Russian intelligence active measures. So it, you know, most laymen, which I am now, I'm retired, may find it hard to judge that it's 100% absolutely them, cannot be ruled out anything else. But I think if you look at the preponderance of evidence, it seems quite likely it was them, and that gives us a very difficult problem on our hands. The KGB and now the FSB, their stock in trade is what they called kompromat, compromising information on people.
Well, you know, and that's not to say that our side in this world don't do the same thing.
That's... Oh, we're by no means innocent in this. And I would even go so far as to say that in the last 25 years, things like the expansion of NATO, the abrogation of the ABM treaty, and so forth, we've done plenty of things that could have ticked them off. That said, Putin has gone beyond that. I think most careful observers of the Russian scene would view it that he, at some point, maybe 2008 with the war against Georgia, he decided he was going to go his own way and the consequences be damned, and he was going to risk it because there was a window of opportunity. Russia was relatively stronger because of the oil prices. Now I think Russia will be getting weaker, not so much because of sanctions or international opprobrium, but simply because of low oil prices. And that window of opportunity is slowly closing.
Well, but this whole situation with Putin and the Russians and the hacking, whichever way it comes out, it's already weakened America. You have a president who hasn't even assumed office, and his legitimacy is in question. And there's a huge cloud hanging over him. And as I say, the idea that you have to wonder whether this man who's about to enter the Oval Office has these kind of skeletons in his closet. I mean, it's not as if he hasn't been on all kinds of... What's that guy, Howard Stern, and said the most outrageous things in the past? I mean, most of what's in this dossier is certainly doesn't seem completely out of character. It's just that I don't think the American people have a clue what they've done here, who they've elected. I mean, this is like, you know, they're about to enter a relationship with somebody that could be a catastrophe. You know, it's like turning a blind date into a husband or a wife.
Well, I'm certainly not going to endorse as the gospel truth what's in that dossier.
No, I don't expect you to, because I
that
don't.
Said, yeah. That said, I don't quite understand this sort of fainting spell that the mainstream media is having about BuzzFeed's release of this, because they waited. I mean, all these media outlets have had this information. They waited until CNN talked about the agency's briefing, both the president-elect and the president, on the supposed compromise, and also senior leaders of Congress knew about it. So then it sort of becomes news.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How the Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at BillMoyes.com, Maybe This Is How Democracy Ends. The Frightening Rise of Authoritarian Populism in the West is a Very Real, Clear, and Present Danger. So you obviously, that, you know, that's why. But I tell you, though, the sad thing is that this story won't have legs because it came from BuzzFeed. And like, if the Washington Post and the New York Times, it's not invented here, they're not going to cover it. Already everybody's saying, well, it's unsubstantiated, and it's not likely to have the legs of that it would have. So I don't think, I think it's going to die, don't you?
Well, the fact that we're talking about it may argue against that, and I think in their own manner of clucking their tongues about it, the ombudsmen and public editors of places like the Washington Post and the New York Times will continue to keep it in the news, if only to cluck their tongues over it.
Well, what's your sense then? I wanted to get to your article at BillMoyes.com. Maybe This Is How Democracy Ends. The Frightening Rise of Authoritarian Populism in the West is a Very Real, Clear, and Present Danger. The CIA officer who ran for president, he was kind of a blip, Evan McMullen. His charge is not so much about Putin hacking the elections, is that he thinks that Putin and that Trump's relationship with Putin is more than some kind of a political olive branch, if that's what it is, that in fact Trump is an authoritarian, and that's why he likes Putin, is that they're similar. And there's no question that the rise of authoritarians around the world is pretty evident, with Erdogan in Turkey, Duterte in the Philippines, and possibly Le Pen in France, Orban in Hungary, and so forth. And there is a phenomenon known as managed democracies, that you don't have to have military coups, you don't have to have generals, you don't have to have tanks in the street. You can have elections, it's just that they're meaningless. So give us your thesis there, because at this point, you know, obviously I don't see how this president-elect is going to proceed unless he is able to. I mean, is he going to purge the CIA of all of his critics? I know he's already wants to keep his bodyguards and not have the Secret Service, but how far in America can you insulate yourself against the normal intrusion, democratic intrusion on power that we have?
Well, the Constitution has written in all kinds of checks and balances. However, since World War II, the power of the presidency and his prerogatives have greatly increased. And that's not so much, in many respects, a power grab by presidents. It's been more an abdication of the field by Congress. On issues of war and peace, for instance, they're basically too cowardly to step up to the plate and vote for an authorization of use of force. They were claiming they were going to back in 2014 with the rise of ISIS, a new authorization, and they've never gotten around to it. Because if Obama were to do it and succeed, they'd say, good job, but why did it take you so long? If it became a cropper, the dirt wouldn't be on their hands. And it's into a kind of congressional somnolence like that and laziness that a chief executive, he's going to push forward. And Trump, it does not take Dr. Freud to see that this guy just oozes authoritarianism. It's in every fiber of his being. Every time he gets up and speaks, it's to the glorification of himself. So there's no great mystery there, and there's no great mystery why he admires Putin, why he, you know, has good words to say about Kim Jong-un, because he sees them as sort of cut from the same bolt of cloth as himself.
I thought he wanted to take Kim Jong-un down a peg or two.
Well, he said sort of contradictory things about him, just as he's been all over the map on most issues. We're going to make Mexico pay for the wall, and now we're going to pay for it first, and somehow they'll pay later, that sort of thing. It is interesting, however, that as much as he's been all over the map on every issue, including whether to throw Hillary in jail, one neuralgic point on which he has never wavered is his admiration of Putin.
Well, Mike Lofgren, I thank you for joining us here today.
Good to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at BillMoyers.com, Maybe This Is How Democracy Ends. The frightening rise of authoritarian populism in the West is a very real, clear, and present danger. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the dossier that was leaked to BuzzFeed.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists, bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists, bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists, bound to lose.
Oh,
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Danielle Bryan, Executive Director of POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, where she focuses on national security, wasteful defense spending, ethics, open government, and whistleblower issues. She frequently testifies before Congress on government accountability issues and was appointed by the Secretary of the Interior to serve on the U.S. Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative Federal Advisory Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Danielle Bryan.
Thank you, Ian. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. And what did you make of this extraordinary circus of a news conference that Donald Trump had to
do? It was something, wasn't it?
It's quite amazing. This is obviously a different kind of, of course, he's not a politician, so I suppose we can accept a certain amount of difference here. But trucking out Sherry Dillon, his lawyer, to make this statement that President-elect Trump wants there to be no doubt in the minds of the American people that he completely is isolating himself from his business interests. And then when she described what's going on, you realize that it's not happening.
It was nothing of the sort. And let's just also point out, she's a tax lawyer. So, you know, she's not an ethics lawyer. And it's very likely that her firm, which is a tax firm, which I thought was also funny because they kept referring to her firm as the very prestigious firm, and we're all like, what firm are you talking about? We've never heard of them before. But it's clear that the underlying premise, just there was no real understanding of what a conflict is. To say we're having nothing to do with the business anymore, we're turning it over to our sons, and I'm retaining all of my financial interests. How is this resolving the problem?
Well, I thought the dead giveaway was at the end of the press conference, and I guess Trump, being a performer, he couldn't resist a good parting line where he joked that if his sons failed to do a good job managing the company during his time in office, he would turn to them and say, "You're fired."
There you go. And you know he would do that to the person who he's hiring, in theory, to be enforcing any ethics rules, too.
But he's admitting that he's going to return to the business afterwards. So essentially, he'll be the absentee landlord throughout the tenure.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that, you know, saying I'm not, he actually had the laughable comment that I'm only going to know what's happening with the businesses from what I read in the newspapers, as though there's someone who's going to be monitoring when they're having family dinners what they talk about. I mean, all of it is so preposterous. And, of course, he has every interest in making sure that they make as much money as they can while he's in office because, as you say, he's going to be taking back the reins. And throughout that time, he is going to be maintaining a financial interest the whole time.
Well, it feels like, and it has been for some time, and, of course, he's not even in the office yet, that we're going to have government by stunt. You know, the carrier thing was a stunt, the Sprint was a stunt. There's never any substance to these offers. And then he threw out today that he magnanimously turned down a $2 billion deal with Dubai in the...
Right, which frankly what that does, it shows us how significant the value of doing business with Trump is for foreign entities, and that's exactly why we're very concerned that he is going to maintain all of the ongoing businesses across the world, which we believe is a violation of the Constitution.
Well, also, doesn't these Trump-branded businesses, and after all, he's really in the business of branding, and he himself has valued his brand at about $4 billion, and he values his holdings between $10 and $11 billion, although that's in dispute. So, you know, 30-40% of his net value comes from his brand, the Trump brand. And surely, if now that he's president or will be president of the United States, won't the Trump brand be associated with the United States of America and therefore be subject to perhaps, say, terrorist attacks? And won't the United States military and intelligence services, the very people that he's trashing, have to protect these assets?
I actually hope that's not the case. I don't see why the U.S. National security apparatus should be tasked with protecting Trump-branded, properties around the world. This really shouldn't be their problem. If you know, he brags about how he's very good at security and he has his own private security, and I'm sure that's the business of the business is for them to take care of themselves from that perspective, I would think.
And again, I'm speaking with Danielle Bryan, who's Executive Director of POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, where she focuses on national security, wasteful defense spending, ethics, open government, and whistleblower issues. She frequently testifies before Congress on government accountability issues and was appointed by the Secretary of Interior to serve on the U.S. Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative Federal Advisory Committee. So there was, of course, his daughter was in attendance there, and the sons were there and on the side. The son-in-law is going to be right at his right hand during his tenure, having the same position pretty much that Valerie Jarrett has for the outgoing President Obama.
Yeah.
It's not credible, surely, to suggest that there's a wall between him and his kids. You made the point, you know, that there's hardly going to be a wall between them when they're sitting down to dinner.
That's right. I mean, you know, but he's making statements that are just patently false. He said repeatedly, conflict laws don't apply to me as president. That is just not a true statement. There are some conflict laws that don't, but others that do. And, you know, he's trying to create the impression that by setting up some half-hearted measures and really giving the operations of the business to your son, in my mind, is not even a half-hearted measure. It's really not doing much of anything. He's creating the impression that he's magnanimous and doing these really sort of an overabundance of caution. No, bribery laws do apply to the president. Anti-corruption laws do apply to the president. And so it's very important that that we start what we at POGO are always going to be doing is continuing to investigate and conduct oversight, because as these business arrangements continue to operate, there's no question in our mind that we're going to start seeing scandal.
So what did you make of the prop on display there, this table piled high with manila folders?
Yeah, you know, did he never explained what was in those manila folders, did he?
Not really. What he said that they were basically the Trump organization that he was turning over to his sons. That was the sort of loose description of that stack. But again, it's government by stunt. I mean, you're not...
Yeah, that is the most meaningless stunt.
Right.
And I would think if it's as big as he suggests as it is, that I would have hoped there'd be a lot more paperwork than that.
But what is meaningful, I think, and the polls indicate that most of the American people feel this way, is that he's never revealed his tax returns. And here he is making a big show of indignation about this leaked government dossier that's extremely incriminating, saying it's fake news and that he has no deals with the Russians and no deals with Putin. And yet he won't release his tax returns. And he said, the only people who care about my tax return are the reporters.
Which,
one,
of course, is not true. And,
right.
And one of the things that people, I think, don't adequately recognizes, he has filed, because he was required to when he was first running for president in 2015, a long financial disclosure form. So there is actually something available that gives a pretty good look at his assets and his debts. But part of why we need to see the tax forms, when you look at the debts, the top bracket is anything over $50 million. So he has numerous debts to Deutsche Bank, for example, for over $50 million. It could be $200 million. It could be $500 million. We don't know what it is. But if we saw his tax returns, we'd be able to see, well, how much debt is he paying? I mean, how much interest is he paying on that debt? And get a sense of what is the magnitude of the debt, which right now we can't tell.
Well, isn't there also a debt to the state-run Bank of China?
It's not reported on his... I've seen that reported in the news, but it is not reported on his most recent financial forms. Now, as we said, that's 2015, and he's not going to be required. He's trying to argue he's not actually required until 2018. We're trying to see if that's true. I'm hoping we can get a more recent, more current one than that.
Well, again, Ms. Dillon, who was supposed to be an expert on these matters, but in fact comes from is a tax attorney.
Yeah.
She said that Trump will only know about the deals that his sons are making if he reads about it in the newspapers or sees it on TV. You know, when I was watching her come forth and everybody in you could see the press were just sort of trying to scratch their heads, what's going on here? It reminded me of that amazing interview on NBC with his doctor, this strange character who wrote an almost unintelligible few lines giving Trump a clean bill of health, and Trump presented that to the world as a clean bill of health from his doctor. And then when you see the guy on TV with his wife prompting in the background, it's this like, we're in a bizarre form of amateur land, aren't we here?
But it's real entertainment. It's not. It's certainly not the way I'm used to dealing with policymakers.
Well, but there was never anything. For example, this entire press conference today, not one word of policy. This is not about policy. It's all about personality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, I would slightly disagree with that, because he was making some points that we found interesting on the extraordinary cost of the F-35 fighter. So there were some things there that we thought were worth noting. It's just when you got to this question of the showmanship and saying, I've now made this big decision. This is how, and this is a long-awaited announcement, especially on this ethics matter, too. You know, we've been waiting for 2 months for this, and it turns out really to be a lot of nothing that's intended to sort of deflect from the real problems that remain.
So going forward then, you know, we've just come out of an 8-year presidency in which there has been no scandal and no whiff of scandal. And you know how hard the Republicans tried to pin scandal on Bill Clinton, and he eventually obliged them with the infamous dress. But they haven't laid a glove on Obama. And this, surely what Trump is handing us now in this lack of accountability, lack of transparency, lack of any kind of understanding of what a blind trust is, isn't this a recipe for scandal going forward?
There's no doubt that I think that journalists like you and people who are doing oversight like us are going to be full of work with someone who just doesn't take seriously the significance of conflicts of interest, the problems with public policy that are influenced by private gain. This is going to be, I think, keeping us all very busy.
So do you think that there's always been some suggestions that, one, that he sort of ran for president to boost his brand and didn't think he had a serious chance. But then, you know, when he got the nomination, there was that moment, I think it was pretty visible on television, like, what do I do now?
Yeah.
Like that movie with Robert Redford at the end of it, you know, he wins the election and then what do I do now? There's that element, and apparently he himself didn't think he was going to win towards the end, and then it could turn around with the FBI letter, and that gave him a second win, and he squeaked by. But still the impression is there that he's always been ambivalent about giving up his business, you know, that maybe his business, his lifetime achievement is more important to him than this job that he may not have really wanted and sort of, you know, kind of accidentally got. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, I try not to speculate on motivation, but I would say it seems to me that he's not ambivalent about giving up his business. He's just absolutely determined not to do it. And he is, I think he has a remarkably strong sense of self, and he thinks he's perfectly capable of being the president while maintaining all of these operations, the financial holdings. And he can do it all.
So you touched on the F-35, the most expensive weapon system in the history of man, continues to get more expensive, and the more you learn about it, the less there is. And it may be that not just the F-35, but its predecessor, the F-22, and all of this stealth technology has been a completely overblown trap that has led the military-industrial complex to try and have a one-size-fits-all weapon system. It doesn't work for anybody. And that stealth,
except the contractors, of course.
Except the contractors. But and stealth itself, which has caused them to build airplanes with peculiar aerodynamics, which are entirely dependent upon extremely sophisticated software to keep them flying. In fact, Russia has the long-wave radar. In fact, you could go back to World War II, the British radar that saved Britain in the Battle of Britain could pick up any stealth plane that there is. I mean, it's crazy.
Not only is that a fundamental problem, but what you see in the kinds of wars we've been fighting in the last two decades, You can never make something so stealthy that it can't be seen by the naked eye. And we have had, shoulder-launched missiles taking down aircraft. So the idea that stealth is essential when so much of the war is sort of third-generation warfare, it's not the kind of warfare that they were imagining when they were first thinking of stealth.
But Trump, when he was running, I think one of the many Republican presidential primary debates down in South Carolina, did talk about the military-industrial complex's excess and that he wanted to give men and women in uniform real weapons that worked and not these extremely expensive weapons. And I believe he singled out the F-35. It's not hard to do, frankly.
Right.
So what happened today? I must have missed that bit.
It was before he started talking about the ethics matters, but he was saying that he has been talking to the generals and admirals, and they understand that he is serious about driving down the extraordinary cost of this aircraft, and that we will be hearing more about that. So could it be then
that this goes down to get back to the inter-service rivalry, which is really how the Pentagon works? Because if you've got a guy like General Mattis in there, and perhaps even Mike Flynn, these are people that have been fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they certainly don't need an F-35 there. And many of them are advocates for more special forces.
Right.
And more equipment for the special forces, which is much more low-tech. Is that what's going on, do you think?
It's very possibly that. He also made reference to the F-18, so I think he may be saying, you know, if we cut back the buy and we start instead investing in many more units of far less expensive aircraft, that's sort of where he seems to be going. I don't think that's crazy. I think that's a conversation that we need to be having.
Well, so just in closing then, you have a little bit of optimism there that maybe he can do something about the extraordinary military budget? I mean,
well, I would say I'm optimistic that he is the first president that has started to talk about these issues really since Eisenhower. So from that perspective, it's not all bad news today. That is something that's, you know, that is encouraging.
But just to wrap up on the other issue, which is why we're talking here, the ethics, that's an accident waiting to happen.
That is absolutely an accident waiting to happen, and there are so many people who are going to be lying in wait just watching for that first transaction that's going to violate any of these rules. It's unfortunately, I think it's going to end up dominating his time in office.
Well, Danielle Bryan, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Danielle Bryan, who's Executive Director of POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, where she focuses on national security, wasteful defense spending, ethics, open government, and whistleblower issues. And she frequently testifies before Congress on governmental accountability issues and was appointed by the Secretary of the Interior to serve on the U.S. Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative Federal Advisory Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.